Kelly asked me at the end of the wonderful presentation on habitat whether there was too much nuts and bolts. And of course, we're talking about Word made flesh, we're talking about incarnation, and coming to this point where we're talking a lot about nuts and bolts, I think is absolutely appropriate. So thanks for thanks for helping us get there.
Oh, I'm just going to begin by saying two brief things. What one is that in terms of concrete ways of living this out, I think it would, that the concrete is unique to each place, and so that will be interesting, I think, that to hear from each place different ideas that have come up, and maybe the rest of us can have feedback and bounce off of the concrete ideas, you know, everybody's had after sitting and listening and talking for these days. The other thing relates to the macro level. And one of the things that I found very hopeful recently has been the movement of particularly Latino immigrants in the rallies that have been taking place around the country. And I've gone to a number of them, including one that was in Washington. And it's something that people haven't been doing at that level for quite a while. There hasn't been that amount of resistance publicly to the war in Iraq. And although some people are saying that these rallies and protests and marches are going to backfire, that some politicians are going to that are going to play into people's fears of immigrants based on these rallies, it's clearly getting the attention. It's clearly requiring a response. It's clearly pressing against business as usual, and I think that's very hopeful. And one of the rallies I went to in Washington, we went to the Senate, senators, when they were right before they, you know, when they were still working on this in committee, and a number of the senators said, "Your presence here is really making a difference. People are really, sitting up and taking notice." And so I think it is important beyond what we're doing locally to, and that's just one example that, I mean, it is making a difference. But we need to be doing that in other areas too.
And before we open the floor, if I could just follow up on that a bit about on the macro, I have to stand because I can't think sitting down. I don't. the analogy, people, you know, this whole business about the principalities and powers and whether with the forces arrayed against us we can do anything. And the analogy I use to people is the analogy of the Chartist movement in Britain, which was campaigning for manhood suffrage in the 1840s. And they had a giant rally in 1840, and it was the biggest rally ever held in Britain. And tens of thousands of people came, and it absolutely poured with rain. It tipped down, and these poor sodden protesters marched up to them, getting wetter and wetter and wetter, and the police dispersed them, and the whole thing just fell apart. And that was 1840. And if you'd taken them away and said, "Look, don't worry, in 36 years' time, all urban males over 21 will have the vote. In 40 years' time, all males, both rural and urban, will have the vote. And in 70 years' time, everybody, women and men, over 21, will have the vote." They would have laughed in your face. But that's actually what happened. And so I think we're at that kind of moment. You know, we're in a kind of 1840s moment. And it's very difficult for us to see how things are going to change, how things are going to turn around, you know? But it was totally impossible for those people then to see how. They couldn't see that anything would change, and the forces arrayed against them of the power of the landlords and centuries of tradition and all that were there, all swept away. That's the first thing. The second thing, I think that there's an analogy between our political situation and your political situation. So our political situation is that we have three parties, they're all identical, and two of the parties, the Tory Party and the Liberal Party, are the product of the 17th century revolution. One originally represented the landed interest and the other the merchant interest. And then because there was no voice for them, along came the Labour Party at the end of the 19th century and it represented the working class. And then after the 1970s, suddenly there was a discovery that the working class had volatilized. They didn't have any electoral power anymore. And so we now have three market-driven parties, and it doesn't matter which you vote for, you get exactly the same policies. And so, you know, we're electorally completely disenfranchised. And, you know, Michael Moore in Stupid White Men says exactly the same thing about the United States. You've got two parties and it doesn't matter which you vote for. I know that there are some differences still. And electorally, you know, we simply don't have, we can't cast our votes for a party which really believes that the environment is important and which actually really believes in justice. There isn't a party that represents that, stands for it longer. And so the moment that we're at is a moment where we're looking for the birthing of some really new political force. Hundreds of thousands of us feel completely disenfranchised. And what's got to happen is that we've got to give structural political shape to that disenfranchisement and create a new movement which can then, you know, take power. It's not going to be the kingdom because that also will become corrupt and so on and so forth, which is what happens to political movements. But that's, you know, where we are. And I think that there's an analogy between our situation and yours.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. There's a rabbi named Michael Lerner in this century who has written a book called The Left-Handed God, in which he is making precisely that argument. And it's a very extended argument about the need for a new spiritual vision. Neither party is addressing the real hopes and aspirations of the American people at all. And he's arguing for the responsibility of faith-based communities to be significantly engaged in helping create that new
commitment. That's to come, is it?
Could you help me understand the logic of creating this new party, if you will, if in fact it's going to become corrupt like the ones are already?
Yes.
That seems to be going down the same road.
Heidi on my left here is a Lutheran, and so let me use a phrase from my friend Martin Luther. Luther says the church is semper reformanda, it's always in the process of being reformed. And so I think human affairs are always in the process of being reformed. We're never there until we're in the kingdom. We're not going to be in the place where we can dance without end in the joy of God. Okay? We're always going to need to be reformed. It's true for the church, it's true for politics as well. And the problem with you know, your country and my country, these, you know, so-called democracies, we think that we're there. Because we can vote every 4 years or 5 years, we think that we've got there. It's a just fatuous mistake. So semper reformanda, you know, so I think, you know, as I say, that there's this new political movement kind of birthing now. And it'll take shape, and we'll have our own Abraham Lincolns and this, that, and the other. But But sooner or later, you know, that party will have its own George Bush and or whatever you want to say, you know, and another generation, you know, 200 years down the line, will have to be having this same conversation. So nothing can be taken for granted ever. I think that's it.
Just one thought that you raised to my mind is just when I first was being trained as an organizer, I went for a week of organizing training in Richmond, Virginia, and took the bus down there. And I remember part of the history lesson they gave us was about the great movements of recent history, the Vietnam movement, the women's movement, and the civil rights movement. And their thesis was that you can't make the movement happen, but you can try to be ready to ride the wave when it comes. Which I think is probably pretty good theology, if you believe that God's the source of these sorts of things. Then that raises the question, how do we get ready for, you know, you read the right books, you can get together and talk about our hopes and dreams, but how can we be ready for the movement when it comes? What you think, what you're proposing is about to break.
Great.
Add on to that, I think that, like, is for the example, you give the example of the immigrant rallies that have emerged. The church can and should join that, you know. But is there, I keep thinking about, you know, I mean, this is just boggled my mind, you know, with regard to the, with the Iraq War, for instance, and a lot, you know, since, you know, 2002, wherever we started. And I'm also thinking about, you know, just the nuclear strikes on Iran that is just almost seems inevitable, you know. And I keep trying to figure out, you know, what does it look like for the church, at least the church is paying attention, or the church is trying to be faithful. What does prophetic voice look like, you know, besides just sort of waiting to catch a wave, you know, in addition to just catching the wave, you know, what does it look like for the church to proclaim publicly and distinctly Christian proclaim in all sorts of ways? What does that look like? I mean, has there been some of that in England, or is it okay that we are just chipping away at the micro level and trying to stir up our own theological reflection amongst ourselves and things ready? I mean, are there other things that the church needs to be about?
Tim, you've got a story about this. Do you want to tell your story about your biblical witness?
I was a week ago in Portland, Maine, not a Bible Belt kind of place. There was a town hall meeting at the University of Southern Maine in a big town hall. 500 people came. 500 people showed up, and it's kind of thing that anybody who wants to gets the mic for 3 minutes. So I went. I wore my collar so they knew what I was, and I said, I simply feel compelled to be here today as a matter of conscience to testify to the witness of the Christian scriptures relative to the issues of empire and war because of the way that they were misused in the buildup of war. And then I said, when I read Christian scriptures relative to the issue, the thing that comes off the page to me is God will not be mocked. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, America, you should watch out. You better watch out because you can get too big and God will not be mocked. God may abide empires with their hubris and their arrogance and their power and their violence and their neglect of the poor and their exploitation of the good creation. He may abide those things for a season, but his abiding that should not be interpreted as his favor or as his fighting on our side. Eventually, he will judge empires because of the things they do, and especially because they redefine morality and reality with their needs. And I said, in the areas of torture and areas of incarceration, we have redefined morality to fit our needs. And we will be, and eventually we will be judged. And I just do this whole thing, you know. The God who was incarnate in the person of Jesus Christ. I don't know if I said Jesus in that. The God who was incarnate in the person of Jesus, either Christ or his Nazareth, is a God who showed himself to be a friend of the poor, blah, 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 kind of thing. And then the bot, you know, said eventually God will not be mocked, and eventually there will be judgment. The room just exploded. I mean, it was amazing. And these people, I was so nervous. I was incredibly nervous. Here I am, you know, with my Bible, my Southern accent in Maine, and my collar on. You know, I'm going to talk to these progressive people from the authority of the Bible. You know, and what is going to happen? I'm going to be booed out, laughed at, kicked on, whatever. And so my throat was so dry, and I finished. I just walked out to get water. Well, this group of people all came around, and it was the Green Party candidate for governor. It was from the local press, and then talked with them and all this. And then afterwards, what really got me were three people. One of them was this woman who came up to me and has basically pitched her Christian faith because of what she sees as Christian collusion with immoral causes. And it's basically one. She said to me, "Will you listen to my story about the emails I get from my right-wing Christian friends?" So I talked with her for a while. The other one was this 24-year-old guy came up to me and said, "Have you ever tried saying this to any right-wing Christians?" I was like, "If you're on here." And then the other was just the number of people who just came up to me and just said, "Thank you." Because what that, it was just amazing, because there was no question about the authority of the text. There was no question about the morality of the issue. You know, this was a very post-Christian, post-modern crowd, but nobody wanted to sit around and talk about, does morality exist? Does this text have authority? Their spirits testify that this is right, and this is about a God. This is about God being bigger than either one of our sides. And there's that amazing story, right, where Joshua, of all people, and you talk about the conquest and the way that the implications that has, and so troublesome in so many respects. And you know, there he is out wandering around, and the messenger of the Lord appears to him, and he says, "Are you on our side?" And even in that context, even then, when they've been given a mandate, even still, the messenger of the Lord says, "Neither one." But as the messenger of the Lord, I'm here, and that's all. That's all you're going to get. You know, it's as big as it gets, even in that moment. So anyway, for me, that was a Martin Luther King Jr. kind of thing. How did King talk about these things? I was helped by the fact that I only had 3 minutes.
Yeah. I used a similar, you know, opportunity at the CCA conference a few years ago.
Thanks again.
Got a very similar response to that. It wasn't actually, it wasn't an explosion, it was just deathly silence, and then the emails and all that feedback. But the thing that I think that, and I think we have to take those opportunities, I think that's really important. I think that the question that I wanted to ask last year when Mullen was here and I failed to do was that I think I've been just wondering, is there a need for, you know, I think the question I have is there a need for the American church to produce another Barman Declaration, that kind of thing? And how would that look? I mean, you know, and I don't know enough about the history that Jenny's working on, But I wonder, is that something that needs to be considered among, you know, whatever percentage of the American church is paying attention? You know, is there a need for some sort of Barman Declaration, and how will it look different from just another statement that's written up and circulated around on email? I mean, is there some sort of need for a larger rallying call in the American church today?
I wonder if Julie would be willing to comment on a call to renewal and the covenant with America that I understand is going to be part of the call to renewal.
Yeah, it's actually looking, it's a statement that's focused very much on poverty, partially because that it's an area where you can cross ideological, we're finding, and theological lines, that there are people who can get that, and they can move forward with that without alienating themselves necessarily from their churches or whatever. But so it doesn't. I wouldn't say that it answers some of the tougher questions. It's still in the prophetic tradition because mm-hmm. the core is central to the prophetic tradition. But it is actually kind of looking for points of agreement, which mm-hmm. means it's going to have.
It doesn't say at all.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't say at all, and I'm also trying to keep it simple, keep it short. I just lay out that everything we try to make short and simple, although that does seem to be a necessity for a lot of, it definitely is for organizing and everything else.
Yeah.
So, but it is looking at what are some points of agreement, you know, and what are concrete things we could agree to work on. So.
Can I just follow up?
Yeah, Laura's coming through.
Okay, and George, would you be willing to talk a little bit about the event that Michael Lerner and others are gathering? That's another covenant that's being written, only it's, I think it's broader
it's
than
broader
the poverty issue. Because I think it's addressing the
network of spiritual progressives is convening in Washington on May, the date escapes me, shortly, mm-hmm. a major event in which is bringing together whole group of persons to try to address the lack of spiritual vision and ask how it can be connected in a political way. This Michael Lerner, who I referred to in the book quite a bit, is one of the leaders who has major Protestant and Catholic leaders. Jim Wallace is involved in it. People's Diverses, Cornell West, and others like that. It all has workshops related to it. Very powerful event that has some promise. So you may want to put it on your screen. And if you do a Google, just do it on Network of Spiritual Progressives or something like that. And look for this conference. Most of us won't be able to be there. But I suspect it's going to be very productive and that there will be resources that come out of it.
I just wanted to notice that I think there's a lot of value in things like what Tim has done in that kind of witnessing and in creating declarations and covenants and whatever. But I still feel like part of the reason we're here is because that's not the only way to witness.
Mm-hmm.
And that living your life in a way that is a model for others and that reflects these values, I think is another really powerful response that we're all called to. I heard a sermon once that said that a Christian should be a person whose life makes others question. Who says, wow, why do you live like that? And so to be able to be that kind of presence and that kind of witness, I think shouldn't be ignored.
If I could just, I mean, no, I completely agree with that. I mean, witnesses are both embodied and proclaimed. I think that's the important thing. The thing that's dissatisfying about both the call to renewal thing and the Lerner thing, I think, is that, you know, there's tons of ways in which we could rally around an issue. There's tons of ways that we could even rally around a social posture, you know. But I think the word I want to pick up Timothy talked about this morning was idolatry, and I think when we go back to the Barman Declaration, it was clearly about allegiance, and it was about belief, it was about who's in charge. That's what I think is sorely lacking. I mean, in all the different movements or statements that are being passed around, it's always about, you know, I mean, we could rail against militarism, you know, but the fundamental issue is our allegiance. So that's what I'm curious about. You know, where is that being talked about? And you know, it seems like that is a much more crucial issue for the church to be. What are we vowing our need to? And how do we give voice to that? How do we rally the church around that? I don't think it precludes joining in these things, you know, in these movements and stuff that are closer to God's intent for His creation, but there's something missing if we are not addressing the fundamental allegiance issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, comment on that. I don't know if you know the book by Ulrich Ducrow, which was published in 1984, called The Global Economy, A Confessional Issue for the Churches. And he started a movement called Kairos Europa, based on the Kairos document in South Africa, saying precisely that we need a new Barman in regard to the global economy, because that's the Moloch to which we bow our knees today, okay? And nobody wanted to bite. And the reason that nobody wanted to bite is that all the churches survived because they got their money in the stock exchange. And so we've had, in the Anglican Church, for example, I mean, there's been a big thing about so-called ethical investment. I think the Church of England's money is now so-called ethically invested. But it's not without taint. Mm-hmm. And so the call to a Kairos confession is actually extremely difficult if your pastor's salaries are coming off the stock exchange. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the principalities and powers, that's the kind of way that we're shackled, you know. I was just for 3 years a canon of the local cathedral. £4 million in the red, that's what, $7 million, in debt. And they've got this beautiful medieval building, no money, not a single halfpenny from the state, they get no money from the state whatsoever. And it costs, you know, millions of pounds to keep up. What do you do about it? Okay? And so they find themselves making all kinds of really nefarious compromises. With millionaires and with this, that, and the other, to try and keep the building up in the name of God, you know, God, the triune God. And it's terribly difficult, because when I was 20, I would have said dynamite it, you know. But I don't think I would say dynamite it now, partly because it's about place, and it's been there for 1,000 years, and it might as well go on. You know, it does say something, you know. So there are these dilemmas in which we're caught.
I'd also say, I don't know, in today's political climate, that statements really have any powerful impact. And that the media plays a big part in this, and I don't think the media would take any of that. A statement, I don't know. I question the effectiveness of statements, but that could be wrong.
Your friend Lee Stewart has talked to the group before. Lee Stewart is an organizer in the South Bronx, one of the members, I guess, of the South Bronx churches. And she's scandalized groups of theologians that I've periodically taken to visit with her in her sort of theological description of the work of organizing in New York City for housing. She's gone around the room and she said, well, you know, what is the most important theological virtue? You know, faith, hope, and love are the ones that get trotted out.
Anger.
Power.
Oh.
Power. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of us in our sort of, you know, attachments to purity and the kind of ecclesial kind of separation, and some, you know, of my theological colleagues have even stopped voting, particularly those who've studied with Stanley Horowitz, recoil, and yet as she tells the story, it's a, you know, and invokes King and those in the movement, she's really talking about the creative use of power. So, you know, when we talk about the principalities and powers, I don't want us to sort of retreat into some kind of notion of ecclesial purity or the purity of this movement that's coming, because to go, you know, to move people from A to B, to get to achieve not the kingdom, but a better social environment for an impoverished neighborhood. Compromises have to be made, mm-hmm. And there's an important task of speaking truth to power, but there's also And there's an important matter of imagining the New Jerusalem and talking about the possible world. But then there's also the more immediate task of, well, what are the two or three or four things that we need to get to the next stage? What is social progress? But in fact, identifying those concrete goals that we need to achieve in the meantime. And it seems to me that, we come back to the civil rights movement a lot in our conversations about this in this country, because it was a movement that was transformative on both material, legal, and various levels, material, legal, spiritual, theological, certainly in some respects in terms of the built environment. The movement imagined the New Jerusalem. It talked about the beloved community, talked about the kingdom, but it also said that the way to get there is to talk about the vote, talking about creating freedom schools, talk about how to change particular laws in particular municipalities. And so, its genius, I think, was combining those two. And so, Richard Rorty makes this interesting distinction between campaigns and movements. Sometimes movements, or waiting for a movement, encourages a kind of quietism. Mm-hmm. And campaign is something you identify and you jump into and you make compromises and you build coalitions and you do what Jim's doing on poverty. You talk to the fundamentalists and you talk to the Catholic workers and everybody else who will sit down at the table. So how does that sort of need to roll up your sleeves and, get dirty fit with this sort of expectation of the movement to come? Something I'd throw in there.
You hold it in tension, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, there's a place for Habakkuk and standing on your watchtower and waiting for God to act. But as you said, he trained disciples for something and they didn't just sit back and they went on to Galilee, right?
Yes. Yeah.
That's where Jesus is going. Leadership is knowing where things are going and help people to understand that's where things are headed.
And I agree that the statements in and of themselves are not the answer, and yet as a Christian who feels very marginalized and who knows that the world is seeing American Christians as something that I am so very not, that I long for some more public statements, and in a way maybe Tim was doing that for a lot of the people in that hall, and if each of us can do that in small ways and maybe in the occasional big way with some sort of covenant, that maybe the mainstream press would include that voice every once in a while in a way that they're not now, and then that's part of the way a movement gets going. But yeah, I agree that statements are not, they're just statements, but I think they might be part of a bigger picture that needs to happen.
But it's interesting to me that the press has picked up on, in terms of the role of the media was very important in the civil rights movement, where people all around the country were seeing in their living rooms what's going on in, Birmingham and Montgomery. And if it wasn't for the media, that's even how these recent rallies were organized. In New York City and Los Angeles, the Spanish language radio stations and newspapers is what got people out. We don't, even those numbers of people aren't coming out in the streets about global warming. I feel like if there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people coming, out in the streets, then there was a statement. But the bodies were. I think the media would pay attention to that, and I think that the government would pay attention to that.
That's precisely the question of Kairos, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe part of the preparation is Isaiah 6. When Isaiah is called, the burning coal goes to his own mouth, none of us has clean hands. And maybe part of our being prepared is to look at how we're part of and profit from the sickness of this empire.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't ever detach ourselves from this empire because we live here. But, you know, to find ways that we can be less a part of the sickness so that we can speak more honestly and openly. You know, King and the leaders of the movement lived the movement. You know, they lived as Koinonia, as one people, as the beloved community. That they demonstrated it in their lives. So when you went to their homes, Koinonia was happening there. And so in some ways, we have to prayerfully seek ways to be authentic ourselves as much as we can, realizing we're always sinners and we're always tainted, but to ask God for guidance in being more of this community. And I see so many of you doing that, much more than I'm doing it. And so that when we can speak out of some sort of an honesty and a struggle, and knowing that it's a struggle for everyone, and we'll be more prepared to speak more clearly.
Can I just tell a funny story?
Yeah.
This is a lovely story. After the First World War, there was a Christian socialist movement in Britain, which was very radical indeed, and how to communicate with people. And in those days, the evangelical church liked to give out little penny pamphlets on the street corner. So people would stand on the street corner, and they'd give you pamphlets for a penny. And I have at home a wonderful pamphlet, which this Christian socialist movement prepared, called Sins and Their Cure, you see. And people would pay a penny, and they would get this book called Sins and Their Cure. And when they opened it, they found the greatest sin is British imperialism, and the cure is to smash it completely. And then it went through, in half a dozen pages, how well to dismantle British imperialism. It's absolutely lovely. You've been there before. Yeah.
Milana.
Wanted to remind us that there are roots in our tradition about the importance of proclaiming, the importance of speaking the truth. Mm-hmm. And it isn't all that there is for us to do, but I wouldn't want to leave out because I'm not sure how it's going to play. It's part of what we are called to do. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about all the moments that you may have not heard, and the rest of the transformation doesn't come.
Mm-hmm. I think a fine way to speak to power, since we're part of this market, capital beast, is to say I'm not going to spend $1.50 for a cup of coffee, or $3.50 for a smoothie, or $35 for a concert. If you're going to talk about speaking to your friends. Friends are sporting $70 shoes, and I've got five pairs of shoes already. I mean, it is such a small thing, but it's speaking from our tradition to the power. It's very effective.
Mm-hmm. I think it's Tim and then Eddie.
Seems to me, picking up a couple things, I really appreciate what Craig's saying a minute ago. There's a need for something that's more sort of explicitly theological about who God is and what our allegiance is, and that God is bigger than these things. Because I have a handful of friends who really want to engage in this stuff, and they look to one political side and they go, can't do the moral agenda, they look at the other one and go, can't do their spiritual lack of agenda. And there's really a need for that base to come out. I think you're right on about, it's King and the beloved community and all that happened there where they brought it together. It's the difference between, I was at a rally for immigration and one of the speakers said, what we need is to have an imagination for this country. Well, the difference between what y'all need is to have an imagination for this country and standing up and going, I have a dream. You know, it's a very different thing. And so, for me, Tim's been very challenging in very good ways about do I have enough of an imagination of what this glorious God, manifesting God's self in this world, in these days, in these issues, like. And for me particularly, that's a question of what is a theology of the resurrection? Because having a Gerald and I brought up in a very evangelical tradition, I was always taught the summary of the faith is Jesus died for my sins, so I ended up in heaven. That's a crucifixion and escapism summarized theology. Do I have a well enough developed, imagined by the power of the Spirit, theology of the resurrection to bring me to the place where I can not just stand up and say what's wrong? That's a good thing to do. That's one thing. But also stand up and say, and I have a dream, and here it is. And then people can go, I like that dream. I'm willing to do that. And it could also allow people to get on and say, I'm not afraid now. You know, maybe some people from the other side can say, that's not a scary dream. That's a dream I understand. Now I know what you're talking about, you know, or something like that.
Thank you.
Well, Tim and I was talking about that earlier. I'm pretty much said what I was going to say. It's that common ground that I think we first have to find. We talk about the politics that's going on, but us as Christians, that common ground is missing there. And is there someone to say, I have a dream, and here's the dream, and then we getting people on board because of that. And you know, I think about the immigration, all the people that came together, they had a common ground. And you saw people come from every city. And even though they wasn't in the same geographical location, a statement was made. The same way with the movement, the same way with the beloved community, the same way with the dream. I have a dream, and here's my dream, and you want to attach to us, and we can go there together. You know, I was thinking about the children of Israel. Most of the time they pulled together, it was for something against God. They complained together. They danced around the calf together. They built the Tower of Babel together, and everything was in rebellion. So how do we pull together? The one thing that happened was in Pentecost when they all came together, and everybody had that one thing in common, you know. And I think that, you know, getting the church on board, with a movement like this, it's probably going to be the biggest obstacle for us before we can get to actually making an impact in that particular realm.
Yeah. Well, you know, Clarence Jordan, who was mentioned here earlier by Overton and Kelly too, is not the founder of Habitat for Humanity, but the founder of Quantity of Farm, is the birthplace of Habitat for Humanity. Like to translate kingdom as movement, and in sort of in the mid 60s he said it's probably time to stop talking about the civil rights movement and start talking about the God movement. And the God movement is the way he talked about the reign of Christ. And it reminds me of something you pointed out in your book on Barth. After Barth's move from socialism, can't remember the date, the socialist thing is out, taking God seriously as in, thinking in fact that God's own politics were more radical than any political agenda. And all of, you know, and so I'm making a case for a movement again. And that seems, that will have to be the story the church proclaims anew and afresh. For American Christians, it means that, well, we do have to pass an international test, don't we, after all? That there is this need for the global ecumenical church, that we can't be contemptuous towards the universal body of Christ, and that Catholicity is very much in the nature of discipleship and the new identity of the Christian. And I guess to get there means repentance. Renewal of who we are. But I, again, this whole thing about imagining a different world, you know, I have students from Loyola, when I taught at a Jesuit college, who are very involved in the Catholic worker movement, and we come down periodically to this kind of conversation. Well, there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans, but I want to suggest that the world would be a better place if a few thousand votes gone
in favor of Al Gore in 2000 rather than George W. Bush, the world would be a fundamentally different place right now. I mean, imagine that. Talking about imagining a possible world, it wouldn't be the kingdom of God, but it would be a lot different than what we have now. So the vote, which the movement almost made into a kind of sacrament, which has been lost and trivialized, I think, has the power to change mass structures. And as an old kind of yellow dog liberal, make that case. Okay.
Well, and that would be where I would basically, I think that there's a level of truth to the thing about all the parties are the same, and it annoyed the heck out of me the way Clinton was selling out the Democrats to the corporate interests, but that guy, it's not the same when Bush gets into power and lets the oil companies write the energy bill. That's a fundamentally different level of selling out. And I think it's pretty cynical and disempowering, I guess, to think that they are that much the same.
So. Well, if I could push you on that.
So
I have no authority to talk about your country. I know very little about it, really. But I think I do think that the idea that power belongs to the whole community, okay, which is what we call democracy. And I think that worldwide we haven't got the foggiest clue what that means. And I think it's, so this business, Tim and I were talking about imagination the other day. So I think, you know, imagination is a gift of the Holy Spirit. We should pray for the gift of imagination to know what on earth democracy would look like, because we don't know. And so different things have been tried, regional assemblies have been tried, federal government has been tried, state government has been tried, all of this kind of thing. And what I would say is, in terms of real democracy, we're in the Stone Age. We're in the Stone Age, and we shouldn't be satisfied with being in the Stone Age. Okay, I mean, it's actually possible to move to the new Stone Age, you know, maybe we could move to, yeah, exactly, Iron Age and so on. And so there's a real task of political imagination to try and think what taking numbers 11 seriously would mean for the whole community. I mean, we're quite good at doing it on the micro level, but nobody has a clue what it means on the macro level. And it's a really urgent political task to imagine a new politics. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I take your point, you know, Al Gore is definitely better than the present incumbent. It's fine. It's not true in Britain. It's absolutely not true in Britain. The New Labour may be more right-wing than Tories. I have no idea. I don't really care. Our imperative is really to get beyond the fantasy that we have a democracy, and to start really asking how we become democratic, because we ain't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just to come back a little bit, I think that's a great project, and somebody needs to do that, and then somebody's also got to be practitioners at the same time.
Sure.
I'm ready to look for the grand vision and read your book on it. But in the meantime, we know that selling out to the highest bidder, the campaign contributions, the way everything about our political parties is being sold, that's got to be stopped. And there's work to do on
that.
And there is the other thing that is a huge difference from when I first went to Bread for the World in the early 80s. And we thought it was absolutely awful what Ronald Reagan was doing. And we just wanted to put a stop to the expansion of our homeless population through his policies. But can we just stop? But looking back on it now, there was at least a creative middle then with people like Mark Hatfield that you could work with. And now it's all been so polarized with by the political consultants trying to just push, the middle disappears and everybody's at the far extremes. And this is no way to govern, just having people shout at each other across, I mean, Grover Norquist throwing his grenades at the other side. You know, we need some civility, please. Mm. So, there's my diatribe back.
No, I agree.
But you're talking about enacting, you know, policy measures that would create the conditions for a richer, livelier debate.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And at the same time, I should, one other little piece of my speech is, I don't want to run for office. I want to be in a prophetic role with standing outside and telling them how to be moral. I don't want to have to get in. To me, I guess I'm enough of an Anabaptist or something that I don't want to get in and dirty my hands that much. I'll leave that to the Episcopalians.
Well, they hire people to dirty their hands.
Outsource that.
Yeah.
I think that's why, to the degree that it's true, to whatever degree it's true, that Karl Rove was able to manipulate the evangelical bloc, that's why it is first primarily a theological task. Because if there is an education of the desire, mm-hmm. pedagogy of desire, in the sense of who God is, that happens and says, I'm sorry, that's not who God actually is, it's not what God actually mm-hmm. wants, mm-hmm. then the possibility to manipulate the bloc is gone because the bloc doesn't exist. That's one thought. Second thought is, one of the fun things I've learned about my new home state is that it being up there in that northern corner of our large country, we lead the country in two things. The city of Bangor, Maine is the only city in this country whose downtown shopping area is committed to having only fairly traded, ecologically sustainable goods in every store. They've actually done it, though. And the second thing, which we lead our country, is more relevant, and that is we're the first state, as I understand it, to have a policy whereby there's a state-sponsored public pool of campaign fund money. And if I want to run for office, to be governor of the state of Maine, then if I get X number of people to write $5 checks, who are registered voters in the state of Maine, write $5 checks, not to my campaign, but to the fund, but they come through my campaign administration, then if I get X number of money contributed to that campaign, then I can have X number of $1 million for my campaign speaking. Now that's a creative solution to the problem of campaign funding, and we're going to have in our gubernatorial election, we're going to have a Green Party candidate who's tapping those funds, a Republican candidate who's tapping those funds, and an incumbent Democrat who is woefully tied to corporate interests and showed no interest whatsoever in tapping those funds. So it's just to say it's a model. Granted, it's a small state in terms of population, so it makes maybe some of those things easier. But it is at least a way that somebody's saying there's got to be a way to make real democracy happen. And that's one possibility.
See, I guess I would love to hear more things like this. I feel like we've sort of talked about kind of what we're fighting against. But I guess I really enjoy hearing more particulars. I mean, like, for example, if we heard someone who has thought of something creative to do with their investments besides putting it in the stock market, I'd like to hear that. Or, like campaign finance. Like, I guess, I feel like that's kind of, I don't know, that's what I'm most interested in hearing now. Anyone who has like creative things like that, particulars, I would be really interested in hearing that.
And I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot. Last thing on that, I forgot to say, So what we're saying is anybody, any candidate from any party who wants us to contribute to that fund, we will do it. I'm comfortable saying it is a moral imperative that as a Christian, I should support this idea. Now, we can differ as Christians as a matter of conscience about which candidate to vote for, but we should all be able to agree as Christians that this is a good thing. So any candidate from any party who wants me to contribute to that fund, I'll do it just as a matter of principle. Mm-hmm. So, sorry. But I'm with you. I'd love to hear more creative ideas.
I mean, I said that one example because I actually really am interested because I've had the thought that I would really like to kind of have some idea where, you know, my investments are going, and especially I would like to be local rather than supporting these things that are destroying everything I love. But, you know, I was talking to a Christian financial counselor in the area, and it didn't seem like there was many sort of like options for investing locally. Besides things that would take, you know, me to have a part-time job and be able to basically start a business or I'm not sure exactly, but you know, something that I don't have the time for. Has anyone tried to invest locally or?
I've got something that just a different kind of investment tool that is kind of new on the internet. That could be I don't know if this one is more national or internationally, but it's called Prosper.com. It's a new way to kind of like an eBay for loans, where local people will say like, well, I need $10,000 to pay off educational debt, or I need this or that and the other, and then you can start an account and fund an account, and then basically. Place bids and saying, I'll put $50 towards this guy's loan. And so it's a way to kind of almost micro-credit through the internet that you know who you're investing in, and you set the rate of returns you're willing to accept based on their credit rating. And so it's kind of, that way you know where your investment dollars are going to, and you'll know what your likely rate of return will be. And so that's kind of maybe, that's a national concept that's just kind of taking off, that maybe something that could be eventually done on a more local scale, on a more type of scale, so that you know where your money is as you're investing. And it's going, you can still get the 10-15% rate of return.
But there's no built-in system, as everything is a risk, but if they default on their loan.
Well, what you do is you just based on their credit rating, also yeah. You get people to join groups as uh-huh. well, and that way, if the people who are asking for loans, if you have them join a group and saying like, oh, I'm from like UVA alumni,
uh-huh.
and because I'm from UVA alumni, I'm more likely to pay back my loan. And
uh-huh.
there's peer pressure then for them not to default, because if they default, then they hurt the group's rating,
uh-huh.
that kind of thing. So there's different mechanisms. It'll take like 15 or 20 minutes to explain the whole system,
yeah.
but that's kind of something to look at. Maybe
yeah.
perhaps an idea in that direction.
Jesse, though, all of us, all of our denominations have credit
mm-hmm.
unions, every single one of us, where you are guaranteed, you know, at least back your investment, and they will then give the money to churches or church groups or nonprofits, and it's all socially responsible. Also, all of our denominations that I know of, I'm sure the Lutherans do, I know the American Baptists do, you can invest your money in socially responsible, and they have a whole study on socially responsible agencies, and you know, they did a lot of that work in the anti-apartheid times, and tobacco and alcohol and all kinds of things. I know it's across denominations. And Sojourners always has ads in your paper,
sure.
in your magazine.
Yeah. I mean, they are more traditional stocks still,
mm-hmm.
which I think, I mean, there's the range
yeah.
of how radical you're trying to be.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, there are more and more funds that do some level
mm-hmm.
than some of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're willing to get a lower rate of return, then
yeah. Yeah,
they actually have pretty stringent standards.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, your financial advisor, as mine has, you know, with a little bit of money we get, has said, you know, well, I don't really think that's a good idea because you won't make that much money, you know, you won't make as much money, but, you know, you can't serve two masters. Which master are you serving? And you know, that's the real decision. But there are a lot of one. I read about them all the time in your magazine.
Well, and we did run an article recently about a community-based credit union somewhere in New England, and I'm totally, because my mind just erases everything that I've just edited, give you a detail on the top of my head, but it was founded by a town, you know, by people in a town, and it specifically focuses on local investment and loans to people who would normally be able to get loans, you know, some microcredit, some business investment, some personal. It had some sort of local church backing, I think, and it's not the only one. I don't think it's a real common model, but there are people doing that. And there are also, it's not local investment, but there's a bank out of Boston that has a community development fund. Now, I don't know which community's development is funding, but there are some investments that are that. You're just investing in supporting community development.
Well, I think they have some FDIC protection, you know, there's some protection so that you won't lose your shirt, you know, if you have to look at your old age, you know.
As far as that local thing, there have been some examples of some kind of local bucks, communities that, do you remember that? Yeah, they make their own money and you try to see how much it circulates with
that. We've tried that. Yeah, it's very difficult.
Is it essentially a way to barter without?
It is, but it's also about how you value gifts in the community, and it's fantastic for academics because basically it's a question of which skills are valuable. Okay. And plumbers and carpenters and things like that. These are people who are really useful academics. I could tell you some funny stories about that.
What's the, I don't know if you've heard about this, what's the, how's it work?
These are local exchange trading schemes, they're called. So there are a lot of them in this country and a lot in Europe as well. So what you do, you set up a local currency. In our case, this is from Exeter, it's called the X, EXE. And when you join, you get a small number of X's. And then everybody in the community is listed, and you say what you can offer. Okay, and you offer a skill, or time, to babysit or something like that. And then you trade with the members in the community, and no national currency changes hands whatsoever. And so you can, if people list their skills, you know, I can teach Spanish or I can do carpentry or I can do plumbing or I can be a beekeeper or whatever. And you exchange your skills. It's a way of trying to reinvent the money economy. Right? It's a good idea, but it does completely reinvent the value of what people are paid for. And so suddenly the world where these kind of skills are really useful disappears. Mm-hmm. And the skills where people can knock a nail in straight becomes really valuable.
Right.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But then you come, then you you begin to realize why we've got where we've got, because how do you stop people exploiting you and all of that sort of.
What do you mean? Like, what's an example?
Let's say, because I'm an academic, all I can offer somebody is my time to babysit. Okay, how many X's is my 4 hours babysitting worth? Okay, this is a concrete actual example. I might get 2 X's for 4 hours. Okay, and what carpentry will my 2 X's it might buy me, you know, a carpenter coming in looking at it and say, well, you need this. It might buy me a bit of advice. But in order to get anything substantial, I need thousands of X's for this kind of thing.
Right.
So it's very helpful in forcing you to think from the ground up what fun is all about and what it's for. And it's a way of trying to circumvent the money economy.
Right. I think that would be maybe I don't know, just thinking how beautiful that might be if I sort of started to do that with my friends. Mm-hmm. You know, even just a small group of people where you know, we just kind of for the fun of it, you know, did something like that, and then it might, you know, because there's that relationship, then you might avoid you know, professors not having a living wage expenses. Mm.
Yeah.
The one I'd heard about, I went to some green conference one time out in Portland, and they were talking about, I think, some small New England town where it was basically a way to promote merchandising on Main Street, and they were trying to build up, you know, buy local kind of thing. So this was to, you know, your cup of coffee and your gift buying and your book buying and all that. You wanted to see how much this Bangor dollar circulates in our downtown Main Street. So that kind of thing, you know, if you had some little outlying village that wanted to try to get folks to buy local instead of going into Charlottesville or somewhere. Right.
I mean, while we're on money, if I could say what we heard this afternoon about habitat is also profoundly undermining of the money economy, mm-hmm. Because most money today doesn't represent goods and services. It actually represents debt. And the you know, I don't know how many of you have mortgages, but you know, in our country, lots of people have mortgages. And if you take out a mortgage for, I don't know, $100,000, let's say, or $200,000, what happens is that then becomes money in the bank. It didn't exist before, but it suddenly becomes money.
Right.
Now, if you've got habitat working like this, it actually starts to subvert the whole, you know, banking economy, and if it became major, you know, the banks would be really worried.
Right.
Now, it, the word mortgage means grip of death, and it does, and so you know, millions and millions of our fellow citizens are caught in the grip of death. So they, you know, they earn whatever they earn, and the mortgage payment has to be in, and it might be a third of their salary or even half of their salary or whatever. And so finding ways to subvert and undermine that grip of death is fantastic, and I think that's one of the things that Habitat is doing, you know, maybe unconsciously. There is, I can't give you the full details of it, but there is a similar scheme in Britain which does what Habitat does, but also sees that when you repay your final installment, you get a lump sum for your pension as well. And that's a pretty neat idea.
Mm-hmm. Your final installment, your mortgage?
When you've repaid your mortgage,
right.
Whenever, however, you're 65 or something, you get a lump sum which is there for your retirement.
Okay.
So, and that's a thing that, because pension funds disappeared, mm-hmm. People are pretty worried about.
Thank you. Thanks so much.